Let's move off into space for a little bit and take a look at a robot rover operating in one of those alien space worlds with our guest today. Because, you know, we spend millions of dollars, or have spent millions and maybe billions, probably billions, to send spaceships with robots to other planets. And despite all the money, sometimes those unmanned vehicles can get stranded. And our next guest is here to tell us why and what he and other people have done to kind of solve the problem. Dan DeGroot is a professor of mechanical engineering in UW-Madison's College of Engineering. He and his team at the UW believe they have found flaws and maybe fixed flaws in how rovers are trained here on Earth, because we got to train them here before we send them off to Mars, for example. And he's done some pretty cool research, and I hope you'll join the conversation. You can reach us with your own questions at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or email us to talk at WPR.org. Dan DeGroot, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Larry, great to be here. An honor to be here. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I'll tell you what. I've kind of forgotten how long that we've been operating these rovers. It's been 50 years or a little more than 50 years.
More than that.
Yeah, 2009, the Mars rover Spirit got permanently stuck on the surface of the red planet. That was 2009. Has it improved since then?
So I want to believe that it has. And I think that one thing that people count more on these days is simulation.
Yeah.
And this is where our group at the university is chipping in. And you said at the start of the segment that we figured out something. I just want to clarify, it was a team effort. And I want to give credits where it's due. It was like a bunch of us. There were people, some people from NASA, some people from a small company in Pittsburgh, like a startup, great company, Pro Innovations. It was a really good friend from MIT. And there were some students from our lab. And in this mix, our role was like, to use computer simulation to basically look ahead to what happens when we're going to actually send this out to the moon. It was, by the way, the Viper rover. And that rover is supposed to go and probe, see, by now people know that there's ice on the moon in certain spots.
Yeah.
And they want to send these to get like clear confirmation that it is, this is how much it is, it's a dead depth, and so on. So that was the project back then, and there are like thousands of people whom I don't know that worked on this. So I'm a small part in a complex mechanism. But what our team was supposed to do was to figure out how you can control the motion of the wheels of the rover so they don't start spinning in place, because when that happens, it digs itself in, and then it ends up having the fate of the Spirit in 2009. So the people in industry, they were like looking at like, how do we control the motion of the wheels? We were supposed to simulate that, and basically it was like a team effort.
I say, as you were talking, I was thinking about my own situation. A couple of different times I've gotten stuck in my car, you know, and you just, the wheels spin, and pretty soon it's hung up on the base, and now you're not going anywhere.
So that's called 100% sleep. That's what it is. When you are like in Wisconsin, especially here in winter, basically your wheels turn and you go nowhere fast. When your speed is zero, longitudinal, translational, and the wheels spin a lot, that's 100% sleep. You don't want to be there. If you're there, probably it's like too late to do anything. So that's what they try to do, to control that, to prevent that from happening.
And what was there was a flaw.
Yeah. So here's what the thinking has been. And this is called gravitational offset. You offset the gravitational pull. So if you go to the moon, the gravitational pull is 1/6 ballpark of what's on Earth.
Okay.
So then people were like doing things like, okay, look, we have a rover. Let's start shedding parts to the point where the mass is 1/6 of what's going to be when we actually send the rover to the moon. Okay, this was one approach. A second approach is like, let's attach a helium balloon to the rover to lift it, offset the weight. Another one is to take a crane and lift it like lightly so all of these things, that's how it was done. And then you take the rover, for instance, go to the Mojave Desert, or sometimes you have like a lunar simulant, it's called like GRC on a certain terrain. And then you look at how it moves, like 1/6 the mass.
Yeah.
And then you say like, oh, okay, well, on the moon, it's going to weigh 1/6. So the pressure on the terrain is going to be like here. So therefore, whatever we see here is going to what we see there. But the problem with that is that you have to basically pay attention to what happened to the terrain, the granular material that this rover moves on. And this is where the tricky part is. And let me spend 30 seconds just giving you an example that can serve as like a preamble to the discussion. So imagine that we have like a deck of cards, or like, for instance, like a stack of bricks. Let's say a stack of bricks.
Okay.
Like, or cards. We have 52 cards. We have like some bricks. We put them here in front of us on the table in between you and me. And let's say that like 10 bricks. And I tell you, Larry, extract brick number 8, which is pretty close to the table, right?
Yeah.
One is the top one.
Yeah.
So then you start pulling and you extract it, okay? So now here's what I do. Now I say like, hey, do it again, but I'm going to go to the top brick and I'm going to start pressing on it. It's going to be harder for you to pull the brick, correct?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely.
Good.
Absolutely.
So here is why this is related to what happens there. So on the moon, it's not like me pushing on the top of the top brick.
Yeah.
But the gravitational pull is lower, so it pulls all those bricks with a lower force. So therefore, it's easy for you to pull out the 8th brick. Does it make sense?
Okay, yes.
Or if I go and I press with an infinite amount of force, you can never take that brick out because the friction force is mu times the normal force. Okay, so that's what comes into play. On the moon, there's nothing to pull down really hard the terrain that you move on, right? The gravitational pull is 1/6. If you take this on Earth, here the terrain is pulled down hard so you don't shear. And if you don't shear, your slip basically is low so you can move. So that's basically the basic observation. It's just like how the terrain shears because there the terrain is more fluffy, so to speak.
Yeah.
So it shears more easily. So therefore, you have a tendency of getting stuck more up there than down here. It's as simple as that in retrospect.
Well, it took a while. And you guys had to do simulation work. I mean, how did your team simulate how a rover works on desert sand on Earth versus Mars or someplace else?
So with a simulator, basically, there's like a modeling part, right? You formulate some equations that govern the motion of the parts that you're talking about. Like, for instance, let me give you an example. Like, let's say you have like a die or like a pair of dice, like two dice, and you throw them, right? And they tumble in air, and it's clear there's gravity pulling down, and they turn. There's some, like, Newton's second law, basically, right?
Yeah.
They hit the ground, there's a force there. You compute that force based on the model. You integrate some equations of motion. You can figure out how the dice roll. It's the same thing on a different scale. For granular material, you don't have two dice. You have, like, literally in 1 cubic meter of sand is probably, like, somewhere between 1 and 2 billion elements. So that's one way to do it. There are other ways to simplify. But long story short, you can predict through simulation how these components, including the rover, will move. So basically with this project, about like probably now it's like 3 years ago. So we were working with the people from NASA, Glenn, next to Cleveland. And that's where the thermomechanics lab is. And they said like, look, how about like simulate this single wheel? Because that's how you start. You don't start with a full vehicle. You start with a wheel. So look, we have tests in the lab, and the results look like this. Can you simulate the single wheel? Oh, yeah, we simulated the single wheel. The results came pretty close, okay. And so, like, okay, now simulate the entire vehicle, but it's 1/6 the mass. Okay, we model, you produce a CAD geometry representation of the vehicle. We simulated that 1/6 mass of the vehicle. The results look, it looks good. But now at this point, and this is the interesting part, in about 5 seconds, you can change like one line of code, and you change the gravitational pull for 1/6, whatever is on the moon, multiply by 6, you get 9.81 meters per second square, and then you run your simulation basically either on Earth or on moon with basically one line of change. One change of line. And then we said first, like, okay, look, we got the 1/6 mass results here. And then now let's go back to the original rover, put the normal mass, and switch the gravity to lunar gravity to see, you know, out of curiosity, are the results the same? And the results were not the same. So then you start thinking, and here, like, Ken, this friend from MIT, so like, look, in about like, I think in 1930s, there were some scaling laws that explain how if you change the size of the rover, or like, you know, the size of the mass of the rover, you can start telling how the forces are. They're called scaling laws. And I don't know, to use an analogy, is the same thing, for instance, like Boeing, when they build an airplane, they do not test the big airplane. They test in a wind tunnel a scaled down version.
Sure.
And there are certain laws that tell you what the forces on the big guy are based on the little guy.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing here. It turns out that there are some laws that you can apply to figure out some relationship. And Ken said, like, okay, let's look at those laws and what they say. And also they'll say, like, oh, look, the simulation that you got with the full vehicle, with the full mass, should be this. So therefore, your simulation is okay, and there's a discrepancy. And then we started thinking about things, and that was our conclusion. Like, okay, there's a gap, and here's the problem. The problem is that, okay, there's a small error there. Unfortunately, the error makes you be optimistic about the performance of the rover, because sometimes you make a mistake on the other side. You are too conservative. But here you say, oh, yeah, it's going to work just fine. And actually, you know, is that like, I cannot tell that the Spirit rover got stuck because of this. But it's a good thing to know, pay attention to, and account for it.
Well, your team used an open source physics simulation engine.
Yes.
Called Chrono.
Yes.
So this is Project Chrono. And this open source means it's free for anybody to use.
Yes.
This is something you guys developed?
Yes. So here's the story with that one. In 1998, a friend from Italy, who's now, back then he was a student, now he's a professor at the University of Parma, Alessandro Tassora, he started that. And in 2007, I started working with him. We started working as a lab on that. So since 2007, we have developed that for, what, now it's 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been very fortunate, and we had funding from the Army, funding from NASA, funding from National Science Foundation, and we kept going. So the software is open source and is also released under what is called a BSD3 license, which means that anybody, Larry, you included, can take it, edit it, sell it, make money out of it, do whatever you want. You have a product, you can take, copy and paste parts of it. But that's how the software is. And there are like a bunch of people working on that in the lab. I want to say, honestly, these days, the amount of code that I write is minimal. But there are people in the lab. I have colleagues, two scientists, Radu and Luning. I have like in the lab, we work together as a team, probably like 20 people, probably like 15 grad students and such. And we do research, but eventually that research is funneled into the code in some shape or form. And the code, this simulator, is basically what is called the multi-physics simulator. You can do rovers, but by the same token, we look at the granular flow in a heat exchanger to understand what the design, an optimal design is to improve the efficiency, how you produce electricity from solar energy. So it has all sorts of, like, you can simulate like the flow of fluids and stuff. Long story short, it's an open source package that we develop. in collaboration with colleagues from Italy, and we also used for our projects. And there are like literally thousands of people out there in the world. Like there are people using it in Japan, in France.
China, I bet.
Probably. Actually, yes. Because a former student, for instance, now is faculty there. But, you know, that's the way, with, you know, it's open source. It's there for anyone to use it and, you know, put it to hopefully good use.
So, and by the way, just to, as an aside here while we're talking, I know it has been used in a number of ways. I mean, I think it was even involved, mechanical watches.
Yes. Yes.
As an example. So, I mean, somebody listening today might have an engine or might have whatever product. I would think it would be open to many products, tractors.
Yes.
Vehicles of all sorts.
Yep.
So the simulator, the Chrono project then was able to come up with a design, or was it?
The simulator, basically, whatever design you have is going to simulate its evolution. It's the way it moves in the real world. The design, how you do it, it's up to you. But at that point, once you have a design and you are curious about how it's going to, for instance, I know that it has been used for a rover that next year is going to go to Phobos, which is a moon of Mars. So people probably used it to understand how they should design the wheel so that the rover can operate in that environment. The wheel has a certain shape. They define the shape. The gravitational pull there is about probably more than 1,000 times lower than on Earth. So they have to move extremely slowly, like 1 millimeter per second or something like that, to engage with the soil, because the soil is super fluffy and it's hard to move on that. But you can run these simulations and understand how your system behaves. And if you're not happy with it, then you go change the design and you run the simulation again. And in the real world, what you do, literally, you run thousands of simulations like that. Also, we have a collaborator, very close collaborator at Carnegie Mellon. They are going to send the Moon Ranger this year, should go to the moon. They've been using the software for probably like years now, and they rely on it, and they gain insights from it. Is that what's going to happen on the moon? You know, you never know that, but that's why you don't write a simulation. You run thousands of simulations to see, hey, what if the friction coefficient is that? Or what if I change the slope on which this moves to that? So you start getting some insights into how this system is going to behave once it lands on, you know, the moon, or like our moon, or the moon of Mars, and so on.
So it's less likely that is going to be much less likely to get stuck.
That's the idea, yes.
If it does get stuck, can you back out of it? Or
yes, the answer is, like, at that point, you generate a model of the rover. Basically, it already did sink to some extent, and you try to see, like, okay, what sort of control policy should I try now? What sort of torque, what sort of angular velocity should I try on the wheels to see if I can get it out of there? So that's basically the idea.
So how, and this simulation software, I assume it's got to be constantly or often updated.
All the time.
Putting in, from what you learn, you add additional.
Yep.
How significant is it for, here we've got a public university of Wisconsin. How significant is it for a public university to develop software of this sort?
That's a good question. For me personally, it's very important, and it means a lot to me. In academia, if you write software, probably you're not going to get tenure if you do just that. You need to publish something out of it. So it's a little bit challenging. So because we try to do something where you write software, you debug it, you profile it, you write documentation, you do unit testing, you release it, you support it. We have a user forum which has more than 700 people who ask questions and such. The good thing is that there is many of us, and people are, I would say, like, super dedicated, and they have great fun doing this. I think that INET, once you have this feeling that, okay, your work makes a difference, it's a lot of fun, and you are very motivated. And I feel like that's how the people in the lab are, and that's why it's fun to go to work every day.
Well, what is AI? What role does AI play?
Okay, so we talked about rovers.
Yeah.
But here is something that probably, I think, is going to get bigger, and it has to do with what is called embodied AI, like a robot, like a humanoid robot. It has what is called, like, if you can think about it, like an autonomy stack, a brain. So it has some sensors. It has, like, I don't know, I'm just making this up. Let's say 4 cameras, 3 IMUs, some LiDAR, whatever. But there are some sensing feeds that it gets. And this autonomy stack, it gets this information and it decides what the next action is, such as move forward or turn left or whatever. Yeah. So here's the basic idea. The basic idea is that you're trying to design the brain of the robot or whatever agent you have. And it's much more effective to do it in simulation because it's okay to make mistakes in simulation.
Yeah.
It's not that we've worked with Tesla. We do have students interning. There's a student right now interning at Tesla and another one going out next month. But it's not like we're working with Tesla, but just imagine this. If they do a radical change in their autonomy stack, you don't want to put a pedestrian in front of a Tesla vehicle to say, like, is this patch good or bad? You can simulate many of these things before you actually
do it.
Because that's very cost-effective. To run a physical experiment is expensive. You have, like, cloud computing now. I can launch 1,000 experiments tomorrow morning, all of them are done, right? That's the basic idea. So that's why I think that with the advent of AI, a lot of the role of simulation, I mean, is going to be great, I think.
Fascinating work, Dan. I want to thank you. I mean, the time flew by here. Thank you so much for being with us to talk about your really cool research, and I hope we can talk again. Thank you.
Yeah. Larry, it's been an honor, pleasure, and hopefully we'll cross paths again in the future.
I hope so. Dan DeGroot, professor of mechanical engineering in UW-Madison's College of Engineering, has done some really cool work. We're going to come back to Earth and take a look at what's going on in the water with algae. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.